but things I've been doing the past year at Berkeley with my collaborators, first Gandhi with Sujit and some experimental colleagues from the Quarry experiment. Molecular excitations, this is something I've been working on for almost a year and a half now with Jesus, Ruben at Stony Brook, and Oren at the IAS. And metastable isomers is a very preliminary project, and it looks like I might have even received one more collaborator at Perimeter while my time here, and I'll tell you a little bit about that too. Great, and these are some additional references for topics I promised to cover, but could not find time to include in my talk.
Wait, where was it? The self-combusting people, where is it?
Self-combusting is not there. It looks like that might be a myth.
Okay.
You caught me.
What is this gastrointestinal alcohol fermentation?
I told you about this, right? This is people who make their own alcohol without drinking alcohol.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. But we won't...
Just talk about that.
I know. It might be more interesting, but yeah, we won't have time to talk about these things, unfortunately. And ways to detect dark matter, maybe with things like that. Yes.
Sorry? I need your slides after you're done. The
It's on Pearsa. They are all online. So.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Cool.
Forever and ever.
All right. Yeah, and this also is doubtful, by the way, and it's not conclusive.
Okay.
Anyways, full disclosure. Here's the outline for my talk. I'll first talk about light dark matter direct detection. I want to spend some time talking about it because there are people in the audience who I learned a lot from their papers, and it would be nice to know that you could use it for scattering processes as well, as I'll show you. And then I'll move on to detecting baryonic forces with the Gandhi experiment, and if time permits, we talk about breaching the inelastic frontier and things you can do with some really cool nuclei I learned about recently. Let's look at the dark matter landscape. I just wanted to provide a different slide to what's usually being presented these days, one of them being the famous XKCD cartoon. But here's what I have. And this is stolen from Cosmic Visions, and they divide it very nicely into how dark matter scatters off of you. So it's probably a heavy or light mediator. And on the other side, whether you're looking at dark matter coupling or dark matter visible coupling. And they talk about different anomalies that exist, and different models that exist, and different ways to detect them. So in some sense, it's a almost complete stocktaking of what we know about dark matter. What are the models that have been built, and what are the strategies to look for something like this. And I had to convert my keynote to PDF because keynote was giving problems. So these things were supposed to appear later. I'm sorry about that. But the point is that I'll be talking about this regime, MeV scale dark matter, and how there are no existing experiments looking for dark matter in this regime. I'll talk about this anomaly. And Junwoo tells me that anomaly might not exist anymore, but for this talk, I'll assume that that's still a open problem, and there might be discrepancies between muonic and electronic hydrogen. And I'll talk about a force that has been invoked to explain it, apart from explaining some other things. And I'll show you that Gandhi can constrain something like this. And finally, if time permits, I'll talk about inelastic dark matter. This is a very plain direct detection scheme, just to show you what Lux-Zeppelin usually does. Dark matter comes in, there's a scattering event, there's energy deposition. In this case, it's in the form of electrons and photons, and electrons get stripped up and down, and that's your detection event, and dark matter goes out. And just to jump to where we are using such a detection model, you see that this is dark matter masses and some reference cross section to tell you how often this is supposed to interact. What you see is that these solid lines are experiments that have been done already. So these are the limits. And we are pushing down to the neutrino floor, after which there's going to be too much background and more precision analysis might be needed to do, or more clever things might be needed to do something there. But notice that there is a big hole here. And in this case, there is spin-dependent cross-section. It's very similar, and there is nothing to the left of this, nothing below 5 GeV, nothing below 10 GeV. And in some sense, this is not some kind of close-mindedness or anything of that sort, because after all, we expected dark matter to be around this range because of the Wimp miracle, and naturally, we started looking in that parameter space to start with. But now that we have seen repeated null results, the question is, what are we going to do next, right? And even though models in this parameter space are more perverse in some sense, and more model building is required, and they do not solve other problems like many models in this parameter space would have solved, nonetheless, it's only natural to start building experiments that could go into this parameter range. Why are there these gaps? After all, very naively, the local dark matter density goes like 0.3 GeV over centimeter cube, and a larger number density of dark matter particles should be there. So you should be seeing an even higher rate than WIMP scale masses. But the typical recoil energies, again, this is probably very trivial to most people in the audience, but I just want to spell this out. The typical recoil energies we are working with is of the scale some reduced mass times V square, and take V to 10 to the minus 3. For MeV masses, this is approximately an EV. This is too small for conventional large tank detectors, which can measure around a few keV. So here's the problem: that there are these scattering events probably happening, but we are not measuring them because we are blind to them. Right? We probably need more precision experiments. And this slide also tells you that you can build smaller experiments compared to a ton of xenon. And you can probably see very similar reach in terms of reference cross sections. Here's some limits from mediators, because after all, if there is light dark matter, you cannot have a crazy heavy mediator. You won't be producing a large enough cross section. So the mediator also better be in the MeV-ish range in order to generate the cross sections that you hope to see. And so there are these plots from a Berkeley group which talk about limits from the mediator itself. You see that there is some supernova limits here, some star limits here, and then they plot limits from experiment they hope to build a kilogram of helium in this case. It's a very futuristic proposal, but it might happen.
Wouldn't 100 kilogram year lines there?
I know.
Okay, wow. And this is 1%, this is full dark matter, though.
This is 100% of dark matter.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's 5%, and you see that many of these limits go away.
Yeah, but then, okay. So there, basically, there's that sliver of parameter space between 10 to minus 32 and up to 10 to minus, let's say, 39. Between masses of 10 eV and 100, 1 GeV.
Exactly. Right here.
That's the only place where it's.
Right. Placed. For a massless mediator model.
And then this is for?
This is for a semi massless mediator. They fix the mediator mass and ask the question, then what? And you see that a different part of parameter space opens up.
No, that's not allowed. This is from supernovae.
So this is supernovae.
Yeah, but there's the other line there. So this is all excluded?
No. This space right here. It's not. I'm sorry. This is rendering so poorly.
Yeah, we can't see it very well.
Right. Maybe I should change the resolution.
Okay.
Oh yeah, we could.
Why is there a hole there?
The hole is there because of the supernova trapping window.
Yeah, trapping window. I see. So the supernova is like this here.
Right.
I see.
Is that a resolution thing I should do to?
I don't know. I think it's the. I don't think there's much you can do. Is the?
Yeah,
the
I'm sorry.
Projector.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until we get a bigger projector, it's not going to be fixed.
Okay.
So this is the supernova that wraps around like that. It's a little thing that goes. Like
right. It's this.
Okay.
So there's space here. There's space here, and also remember that limits from B to K phi and K to pi phi are limits created assuming some kind of model that generates your nucleon coupling. So it's not an entirely model agnostic limit, but in some sense. the most perverse model you can build to generate some nuclear coupling like that. I'm not claiming that there is huge swaths of space yet that's left, and that's why I show this plot. I show this plot because there are gaps, and these gaps are possibly small. But if you take a union of all these, you see that typically about an MeV mass range, you have these white spaces that could possibly be attacked by experiments. And in some sense, that is also maybe a good thing to do, because there are only these small gaps, and you don't have to keep doing it. Tomorrow, if I don't find MeV scale dark matter, would I ask to build a KeV scale experiment? Possibly not, because of this line provides closure to me in some sense. That if there is dark matter below 100 KeV, it's probably ruled out by horizontal branch stars, and if it's too weakly coupled, I won't see it in a detector anyway, right? So in some sense, it's like taking the dark matter detection project process to its natural conclusion, in that you have left no stones unturned and want to cover all the parameter space.
It's quite natural to think that there could be a mediator at that mass range, but it could be also some freeze-out and decay model, right? We're not really forced to think that there should be a mediator at that mass scale.
Right, so where would your mediator be?
I mean, there could be some scenario in which you have a freeze out and decay, so there is no mediator at the scale. You have another particle which froze out before,
right,
and decays, and but the decays goes.
Good. So I'm not claiming that freeze out cannot happen, but now you need to construct a mediator to explain what the reference cross section you built is. So for that you need a mediator though, right? And that mediator is what is constrained here. If you see, there are not many freeze-out model lines here. Even that has been, we've thrown caution to the winds and asked the question, okay, I do not know how dark matter came about, but just from the fact that I want to see it today, I want to see what are the possible models I could build.
Okay, understand now, yeah.
Great. And here's millicharged particles, and here you have a little more optimistic parameter space. But again, you see this really nice, here it's around 10 KeV, but typically it's around 100 KeV. Again, these things change based on mediators and things like that. But there is always this line coming about on the left-hand side that comes from a horizontal branch cooling and things like that on the mediator or on the dark matter itself.
But those masses, though, you also have to take into account the whether or not it's warm dark matter, right?
Agreed. I won't be going to that mass range. Yep. Yeah, but definitely.
You don't go there. You're above 1 MeV.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Right. But I just want to show you the different parameter space that exists. And but the thing is that these are all being adequately probed by experiments which look at electron recoil, like Sensei, Damic, Super CDMS. These are all coming about. And unlike the plots I showed you here, these are already in the building stage, while those are in the R&D stage. So these things are 100% happening. Okay, good. So now I want to ask the question, how am I going to look for these EV scale energy deposits, right? And I want to attack them through gap systems. And the question is, can these gap systems be excited by dark matter scattering? And if so, can I find ways to trigger on them? And this is in no way a very original idea to use these gap systems. These are ubiquitous in dark matter literature in the last few years. Examples of these include semiconductors, superfluid helium, polar crystals. Some of them are very ambitious, some of them are already happening, and there's a whole mix of these things. And I show you some references here where these problems have been attacked with all these different gap systems. Okay, for my talk, I will look at molecules, and I'll tell you why molecules are interesting in a second. But to start with, these are typically described by a Mohr's potential that explains the attraction and repulsion between two atoms two nuclei of the molecules. And it's approximately a harmonic oscillator potential. So a lot of intuition can be gained from the fact that this blue line can be approximately written as this green line. This causes a rich spectrum of vibrational levels and rotational levels, and this means that you can do a lot of fun things, playing with these different levels, seeing what can happen. Fortunately or unfortunately, these V levels are approximately equally spaced owing to the fact that the harmonic oscillator potential is a very good approximation. And the level splitting is typically 500 milliEV. You could go down as you go to heavier and heavier nuclei. But hydrogen, for example, has a 500 milliEV V equals one state. Right. So the smallest energy gap you can possibly measure, I've not told you how to measure them, corresponds to a dark matter mass if you multiply by 10 to the 6 corresponding to V square, and you get a 500 keV and above. In some sense, this is the natural lower limit of dark matter detectors I would build from such a molecular scattering process. I would like to point you to an extremely useful reference. Two of the authors are in the audience with us, and we relied heavily on them. They did a lot of the heavy lifting for us, and it's a really cool idea involving absorption of bosonic dark matter in the lower mass range directly in molecules rather than scattering. Okay, what's my method? I'm going to cool my tank of molecular gas to temperatures where only V equals zero state is populated. So typically, this comes to around 40 Kelvin, 50 Kelvin, thereabouts, where something like this works. Of course, it depends on the energy level of the molecule I'm considering. Dark matter scatters molecule to an excited state. The excited state decays by emitting photons. And we have single photon detectors to detect the signal. And we require typically a multi-photon signal to beat other backgrounds. Okay, so two or three photons to beat other backgrounds. Okay.
You'll come back to the last point.
Yeah. This is not the end of. I'm not going to show you results immediately. Yeah. that would be crazy. Challenges: dark matter number density is much lower at an MeV than the EV that corresponded to bosonic absorption. Because there, the energy directly corresponded to the mass, whereas here, the energy corresponds to 10 to the minus 6 of the dark matter masses I'm considering because I'm doing scattering. Now, here, what could happen is there could be collisional de-excitation that could compete with decay through photons. Because in the case of the absorption, they had something called cooperative emission, which makes emission rates much higher than usual, whereas in this case, I do not have something like that. Because the momentum transfers in my case are much smaller, as a result, I have much smaller coherence scales, and I cannot play with coherence like bosonic absorption played with. So these effects can kill you. And there could also be resonant reabsorption of the signal photons in gas, drastically reducing the mean free path. What this means is that let's say I'm using this gap system. I'm going to some V state. I'm going to say V minus one. Because of the approximate equal spacing of the harmonic oscillator potential, you could get immediately reabsorbed by the ambient ground states all around you, which means that you're going to have crazy small mean free paths from such a system. You also have low energy of the single photon. I told you that are typically 250 milliEV, say. And so you can't use things like PMTs to do this. You need to use things like MKIDs, which typically have centimeter square areas. So we could talk about small areas, whereas my typical gas, my gas tank will be pretty large. So I need to figure out how to get all those photons to the small surface. Again, compared to absorption, where there is some directionality involved, I cannot focus my photons because of Liouville's theorem. So I need to do something different to mitigate this problem. What are the molecular candidates I could consider? I'll do that first before going to the games we play with the optics to get these photons out. We first consider homonuclear molecules. Homonuclear means the same atom, H2 or N2 or things like that. And needless to say, they have really small dipole moments, which means that they have very small decay rates. And if I want to do time coincidence where I do subsequent decays, I better have large Einstein coefficients, large decay rates, so that the subsequent decays happen close enough so I can do time coincidence. So I go to heteronuclear molecules with smaller decay times. However, a larger dipole moment also means that there are large quenching cross-sections, which I need to deal with. So I need to play between them. I'll spare you all the other details, but we found that a carbon monoxide is this nice medium between having large decay rates, at the same time having smaller quenching rates, but there could be other candidates out there which work for us. And I'll walk through all the rates for CO more carefully, but I wanna show that not all molecules work. So there are very few molecules that work, and then there is this fine line you need to walk between being quenched and making sure that your photons are actually emitted rather than waiting a year for them to come out. I'll just go through overview of rates now. The decay rate is obviously set by the Einstein coefficient. There could also be something called resonant quenching, which again kills a lot of ideas we had before. And what that says is that if dark matter excites CO to CO some V state, it collides with the ambient ground state and goes to V minus 1 and 1. And this is again because of the approximate harmonicness of your potential. This rate is abnormally large because of approximate harmonic spacing. Resonant quenching, however, is lower for the higher excited state. As you saw in the plot a few slides ago, as you go to higher and higher excited states, you have smaller and smaller spacing, and that rescues you. So there's an exponential suppression in this quenching rate if you go to higher and higher V modes. Finally, there could also be an inclusive process that just steals your signal into heat or some kind of kinetic energy, which you can't play with at all, and that I call inclusive. It could either be with helium, I'll tell you why I need helium in a moment, or it could be with CO quenching itself and just producing some crap that I'm not interested in. Okay. So let's ask, okay, how am I gonna increase my mean free path? I mean, I told you it's gonna be very small. Just to give you an idea, if you just open the box and do the simple 0 to V equals 2 mode, you'll probably get a centimeter or something like that. And with a centimeter cube of gas, you can't do anything. These models are probably ruled out by the fact that you are alive or something like that, because dark matter will be heating you up for cross sections I can measure with that smaller tank. Okay, so what else can I do? What if I did go to a state that's V that's very large, and then did off resonant V to V minus 1, and subsequently V to V minus 1 to V minus 2, such that both of these are off resonant with the ground states? Okay, and this is apparently good enough to have near infinite mean free path, just from the fact that there is off resonance between the V to V minus 1 and V minus 1 V minus 2 compared to the ground state to the first.
So let me understand. So now, so you have everything cooled to the ground state. Dark matter comes in, excites you to the V state.
V state.
Then what you look for is the photons that are emitted from the transition from V to V minus
1.
How big V has to be to get
right.
something that, that where you have, because you rely on a harmonicity, right?
Right, right. So it so happens that I oversold the near harmonicity. In terms of resonant absorption, it's not a big deal. It's only in the case of resonant quenching that it's a big deal. In fact, even different rotational states are mutually transparent to each other. Now, you don't even go to a difference between two vibrational states. Even a J equals not one. If you're off J, you're still good.
Oh, okay. So
yeah.
It's
not a big deal.
Okay. So it can be basically anything.
It can be basically anything apart from the 0 to 2.
Okay,
right?
So basically above 3.
Right, but that is also exactly where resonant quenching becomes a problem.
Yeah, exactly. Right? So you're fine.
No, you're not fine. I would have ideally liked to do 0 to 2, because 2 would do 2 ones, and I would just decay that. I would just look for the 2 ones to decay.
Yeah, but then you cannot do it because of resonant quenching.
Exactly.
So you go from 0 to 3.
3.
Exactly, but that's not necessary. I mean,
so
you can still do things, right?
I can still do things. I'll show you how bad it is, though, if I just did 0 to 3.
Okay.
Furthermore, this large MFP means that I could build a big detector with mirrors, and I could look for a crazy number of reflections before it finally hits the detector. And I'll again show you limits on what this crazy number of reflections allowed is. You always have this subdominant V to V minus 4 and V minus 4 to V minus 8. And this 4 is a magic number, because if I do, instead of the 250 milli EV I have, if I instead have a 1 EV signal, I can start using PMTs to look for them. And PMTs are super current technologies, whereas MKITs, probably 4 people in the world know how to do this experiment. So that makes a big difference. So today you could go to anybody, ask for PMTs, and then probably start looking for the subdominant V2V-4, V-4, V-8 signal. Okay, I'll just show you a graphic. Again, this is because one of my collaborators needs a Nature publication, so he came up with this. And as it goes to the subsequent projects, you see how terrible my own drawing skills are. So it's nice to work with AMO people because they know how to draw stuff. The results, as I showed you, result in a very large tank. Size is limited by refrigeration limitations and reflection efficiency of the mirrors. So the typical reflections in a very narrow frequency band could go to as high as 1 part in 10^5 that gets absorbed when impinging on your mirror. So you could do 10^5 reflections very naively, and that in some sense sets the area of the detector sets the largest cube you could have. Again, we limited ourselves to a meter cube because we think that larger than a meter cube could be very hard in terms of setting the right pressure, making sure there is equilibrium inside, and making sure refrigeration works for that whole volume. To prevent resonant quenching, go to the lowest pressure, to the highest pressure that's allowed by these rates. I'll show you the rates in a second. And higher pressures are allowed for larger excited states because the harmonic approximation is more and more poorly valid as you go up. But you are in some sense taking a hit in terms of the dark matter masses you're sensitive to because the smallest mass gap you're probing is larger when you do this compromise. Okay, here's a list of all the rates. I'll walk you through them. It's a very busy plot. Firstly, here is blackbody radiation, 2 gamma. What it says is that let me ask for blackbody radiation in a centimeter square detector and ask a question, what is the chance that there is one event per year that has 2 gammas within the Einstein coefficient? So the Einstein coefficient, in my case, it's like 1/100 of a second. So within 1/100 of a second, what is my 2 gamma? And I do very, very well. Otherwise, this is something like 40 Kelvin where it's allowed. And because I'm doing time coincidences, I can push it by a little bit. I can go to a higher temperature. Okay. And so that's my 55 Kelvin hard cutoff. I can't go higher than that. And here is my CO clustering, which I didn't talk about at all. What this gray line tells you is that at such low temperatures, if you want CO to be a gas, you need to be at lower pressures. I can't go to very high pressures because of this. And here's finally your regular quenching rate, which is your inclusive rate.
So this have to be below this line?
I have to be below this line. Okay. And I have to be below this dotted line because that's your typical quenching rate. Right? If you do some NDA, that will be your quenching rate for your process. But what happens is that there are these resonant quenching rates which do way worse. So if I just did 2:1, I wanted my 2:1 to go through photons rather than resonant quenching, I would have to be below this blue line. That's what this plot says. And as you see, as you go to higher and higher excited states, I'm allowed more leeway. I can go to higher pressures and still live. Okay. So to come back to your question, if I want to do a 3:2 and a 2:1, I have to stay at this paltry 10^-7 bar. Okay. But if I could do 0:10 instead, I could go all the way up to say a millibar even, and I would still live. Because there
Your threshold now is higher.
At the expense of threshold, but again, in the log-log plots, these don't look that bad,
yeah.
Right? And it's crazy because I spent a lot of time trying to make 0:2 work, and then it doesn't show up in a log-log plot. It's sad. There's good physics in the 0:2. I'm going to show you in a second, but it doesn't do much. It's extremely uninteresting in terms of detection. And here's the M effective. So I fold in the fact that, sure, there is an order one fraction which is going into these resonant quenching processes. Of course, that's a signal too, right? So what would happen is if you allowed resonant quenching to happen instead, then the 9th excited state would produce 9 CO1s because it would just keep getting quenched to the lowest state possible. And those 9 CO1s would produce photons. But the problem with those photons is that they would get reabsorbed. they would eventually come out. They won't have time coincidence. They would just do some Brownian motion inside your gas and eventually come out, but they could have crazy time differences between them. And I do not win with respect to the black body variation and things like that because of that. All right, so this red star is where I would live for 10 to 9 to 8. You see that I can do around 100 gram for the 10 to 9 to 8 process. And for the case of 3 to 2 to 1, I've not shown it here, I actually have to go to lower temperatures because there is also a mild temperature dependent for these resonant quenching cross sections. So I would live at around 10 to the minus 7 bar at 40 Kelvin. And I will show you numbers in a second for the M effective, the effective target mass I have for this system. Here's the second method. And this again, some of the ideas are stolen from the papers you guys wrote. This is pressure broadening through helium buffer gas. Here's something cool I found reading this paper, and that is the following. Let's say you have a resonant photon coming out, right? And I slowly increase the pressure of CO, right? What is the opacity or what is the mean free path of that photon change? Very naively, we would think that the mean free path of the photon would decrease because you have more acceptors, right? But what happens is there is Doppler broadening. So there's a broadening of these lines. They are not resonant anymore. They're just not sitting one on top of the other. They are broadened. As a result, there is a negating effect. Larger the pressure broadening, you have a larger mean free path. These effects cancel, and for larger pressures, you do not have a change in the mean free path at all. So more acceptors, more pressure broadening, these effects in this limit cancel. Now the question is, can I replace CO, which did the pressure broadening, with helium? So at the expense of not having extra acceptors, for free I can do some pressure broadening. So this is the idea. Introducing an impurity makes this thing more transparent, which frankly was super cool. And I probably rediscovered the wheel here. Probably MMO physicists probably know this when they in AP 101 or whatever. But I felt very happy knowing that such an effect exists. This results in a more transparent CO. Also, multiple CO isotopes work. There are 6 different stable isotopes of CO that you can put in. They're all slightly different in their frequencies, and they're all mutually transparent with each other. And as I alluded to earlier, there are different J states, 4 of them, which are populated at 40 Kelvin, and they are all mutually transparent too. Put this all together, you're jacking up the mean free path every single time. You have 24 times the mean free path here, and then you have a crazy, even crazier mean free path, because after all, helium, another thing you should know is that helium is a monoatomic gas, and as a result, it's way more difficult to liquefy it. At 40 Kelvin, whereas CO can, as you saw, maybe do 10 to the minus 4 bar, I can do 10 bar of helium. Maybe I'm overselling that. Maybe I can do 4 bar of helium. I'll just show you in a second. So this will be my setup. There'll of course be the mean free path, and just from symmetries, you see that you would put your detectors on the two lids, and the length of your cylinder would be the mean free path that you so carefully constructed, saving up on all these effects that came about, and you would cover the walls with mirrors. Now the V equals 2 state. I did all this jumping through hoops so that I can measure the V equals 2 state, right? The V equals 2 state is followed by resonant quenching that produces 2 ones, and the high rate is obviously because of approximate equal spacing. Each V equals 1 decays now through approximate time coincident photons. Okay, both photons reach the lids because of how I've constructed it, right? Don't take L too seriously, it's probably L over 2. This is just a representation. With very high probability, and this is what you have. So instead of the paltry pressures you had to work in, say around 10 to the 5 minus 5 bar of 40 Kelvin, instead you can go to 4 bar for CO, right? Of course, the collision rate of helium with CO is smaller, so you do not get the full 10 to the 5 increase in mean free paths, but you get a good chunk of that in increasing your mean free path. Your operating temperature and pressures are set by, of course, the rate hierarchies, and keeping CO and helium in the gas phase. So what's also quite interesting is you can go up and down the CO pressure, because as I told you, the mean free path doesn't care about what CO pressure you sit in. Okay, what's the target mass? Your target mass is so here I put the different pressures, and finally the interesting numbers are here. Even after doing all those gymnastics, I only get 30 micrograms for the small volume setup for a centimeter square. Whereas in the case of the large volume setup, the dimensions are set by how much I can refrigerate. In the small volume setup, I'm limited by the target area, my detector area. So if I can jump from 1 to 100 centimeter squares, this is a 5-year projection, we can do 3 milligram instead. Right. And of course, you can do MKIDS and TESS. What I don't show here is the subdominant process, which I told you about, which is, say, a 10 to 6 to 2 that you could do. And that would receive a penalty of approximately 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 7. So any plots you see, if you multiply by 10 to the minus 6, that is something you can do today with PMTs, especially the 0 to 10 line. Others, maybe not. OK, here's a cross-section calculation. It just calculates the different form factors. FDM depends on the model you're interested in. And for the gas, we use the numerical wave functions that AMO theorists give us instead of the Morse potential, because the Morse potential by itself might be a bad approximation at higher excited states. So this is all in the details, but this is just a usual scattering calculation you would do for a simple harmonic oscillator. This is finally the reach. So first I show you what would happen for a gram of different excited states. Right. So of course, you take a beating because you go to larger and larger energies. And you see that the peaks are at different points. And as I told you in a log-log plot, the fact that I worked so hard to get the 0-2 line is not that big a deal. And finally, this is the corresponding plot. This is for a massive mediator. Massive here means that your mediator is more massive than the momentum exchange of your scatter. So it doesn't have to be that massive. And you see that for the small volume setup, these are the plots in purple. You have a 2-year projection and a 5-year projection. And finally, the blue is the 0 to 3. And finally, the green, which kind of bosses over everything else and probably can be done in the next couple of years, shows you limits for all these masses. Yeah?
What are you assuming about something like a radioactivity or a cosmic rays?
Right. So we have not done a very careful analysis of the radioactivity, and this effort is ongoing, but we believe that cosmogenics are very well under control because you would have active vetoes around your tank. But in the case of intrinsic radioactivity, a more careful analysis has to be done in terms of what is something like C14 or potassium, what is the rate of it producing just 2 coincident photons without anything else, no other activity in your system. We believe that to be low, but a more careful analysis has to be done to.
So how low do you need to get them to be, like if you want to get these like lines?
So these assume, I believe, 10 events per year. So we want 2 photon coincidences and nothing else in your tank to be less than 10 events per year.
Like a radioactivity, you should give you like showers too, right?
It'll give you showers, but would it give exactly 2 photons at exactly 250 milliEV? I don't know the answer. But typically, it would lead to more. But yes, we have to do an analysis of how radio pure we can do this and things like that. I agree that is a criticism we need to address. Yeah.
That's 1 per month.
Huh?
1
per event per month.
Right.
Right.
An event per
10
month.
10 events per year is like an event
right,
per
right,
month.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all the last question then.
Yeah, it's all your fault.
Microphone first.
So, oh, yes. Yeah. God Almighty, your head.
Okay. Where do I put this?
Where was it?
The shirt.
Oh, did you remove the... You removed the...
The shirt.
No, but he doesn't have the clip.
No, no, it's there. Yeah,
is it there?
Yeah.
No, I think it's just the mic.
Yeah, everything is fine.
Oh,
just
okay.
Has to put the...
Okay.
Here.
there's no clip.
Yes. It's on the. It's on the.
I'm glad this is being recorded.
Probably cut this part out. Yeah, I'm of bloopers.
It's like wardrobe malfunction.
Yes, we made it to the bloopers.
Segment that will have many hits the website.
All right. I apologize for our appearance. But,
don't worry about it. Yes.
Hey, hey, we're good. Yeah.
I think we did. We found the clip.
Okay.
Yeah, you see? By the way, meet
Dad. I'll get Yeah, you probably have to wash your mic after this evening. Anyway, so coming back, yeah, I agree that radiogenics are and that's work that's ongoing and that has to be dealt with. Moving on, here's some massless mediator limits. If your mediator is much lighter, then this would be what you get. And you see that because massless mediators, you actually do way better for smaller mass thresholds than larger.
I mean, this fits well. I mean, you haven't superimposed those plots that you should.
Yes, I should. But the point is, which one would I? I would have to do the different plots, right? And then there's just way too many lines. Exactly. But I hope I conveyed that if you overlaid every possible combination, then a large part of this parameter space opens.
Yeah.
So that's why I wanted to show you that in the beginning, because we are aware that exists, that there are smaller spaces than what I show here, and it's not obvious what those spaces are. Okay, this is fun. So I wouldn't say that I started off knowing this, but the fact that I could add those different isotopes to create transparency meant that I could also start probing spin-dependent cross-sections because there were ones with odd number of neutrons in there. And so this came in for free and fell in our labs. You can now start doing, for the first time ever, cross-sections that are spin-dependent, which most of the other ideas that want to do with a kilogram of stuff cannot do. So that's that. Those limits are here again. Work on the Simon Tongyan stuff on whether these are viable at all in terms of mediators does not exist. It's way more difficult to find, say, an axial vector at smaller masses because there are problems with anomalies and things like that, which are way more constraining. It's very much easier to write a dark photon down, but there could be axion mediators, things like that. So again, I would like to tell you that you should take this plot with a grain of salt. A large part of this parameter space might be ruled out. We don't know. And that's something that probably has to be done in the near future.
You haven't spent much time thinking about the model for this one.
Right. I haven't.
That's okay.
Yeah. But it's thankfully, it's not the only thing it does, right?
No.
Right, yeah.
But this is a color. It comes with the experiment.
Exactly. Yeah. So it leads to spin-dependent interactions. So that's the end of part one. What is that, 45 minutes?
Yeah, continue, but we're asking questions.
Yeah. So this is part two. Definitely I'm not going to part three, but I want to ask the question. You saw that the mediator limits were pretty constraining. That's what we took from the first part of the talk. Next question is, can I constrain the mediator itself? And I'll deal with only nuclear forces here. For light dark matter, direct detection media cannot be too heavy, as I showed you previously. And this is an opportunity to constrain the mediator itself. This is what is done by Na64, BDX, LDMX, all these experiments proposed to look for forces coupled to electrons. Right? This is a much easier thing to do. We understand electrons very well. And there is typically not much hadronic activity in these cases, which means that you could do a very nice MET experiment. Right? So these are limits. These are Babar limits. These are Bell 2. And if LDMX ever gets built, then these would be the orange limits that you have. You see that it goes to around epsilon square of around 10 to the minus 14 for a MeV-ish mediator. Okay? Nucleophilic forces are much harder to constrain.
Sorry, can I ask? You may not know the answer to this. Why, as the mediator mass goes down, the reach gets
better,
lines get What are the lines actually? What are the lines? The solid line, the dark.
Oh, the solid line. So I couldn't find a dark foot on only plot from LDMX.
Oh, I see.
I know why this is. This is because they pride in themselves as a dark matter experiment. So all their plots are with dark matter getting produced. But you could always read out the epsilon square from it, and that's in some sense what I'm.
Assuming that the mediator couples to something that decays to two dark matter particles.
Exactly, exactly. But it's produced on shell,
yeah.
So it doesn't matter that it decays or doesn't decay,
no.
Right? But you get that for free. If so, in some sense, these are all heavy mediator dark matter plots, if you want. And what I want you to take from this plot is that there is ongoing effect to constrain electronic forces, but there's not such a similar effort for baryonic forces. And this is not a very contrived model that couples to only baryons. Let's say there was a very light scalar that mixed with the Higgs, you get yourself a nucleophilic force that has a very small coupling to electrons. So I believe that it would be nice to do a similar exercise for baryons, and that's what I set out to do. And let's look at the status of nucleophilic forces. Again, this is from the Knapp and Lin Zurek paper. Here's your supernova limit. Here's your horizontal branch stars. And here's this window which says that if the coupling is too strong, then these objects get trapped in the supernova and never come out and do not lead to novel effects that you should have seen with supernova 1987A. Okay, you might tell me, hey, this is some stupid white space here. Why do you care? I care because most of the baryonic scattering experiments that are proposed to be built, or the last 40 minutes you listen to, in some sense, take advantage of this gap here. And this,
Where's us? Where's the gap?
The gap is here.
No, the gap is there. In the other plot, where's the gap?
The gap is here.
Oh, it's in between. Okay.
The gap is here.
It's there, and then.
And then the gap here is here.
Yeah. There you go. Okay.
Yeah. The gap is here. Yeah. My bad.
It's not your bad. It's the projector's bad.
Yeah. Maybe. Maybe I should improve resolution or something. This happened in Oregon, and I changed the resolution at work.
Anyway, continue. But
anyways,
we have it too bright because this room is usually too bright, so it washes out the color.
I see. Anyway, so the point I'm making is that if you could make headway, if you could make headway in constraining the mediator itself, you could rule out a large part of this parameter space without building experiments that are looking for dark matter, because you'd say, hey, there are no models you should be looking for here. You should probably be reusing standard model mediators at that point. You should be constructing models which do some dipole-dipole interactions or millicharge or something like that. Those are the only models that would be allowed. And those models can be typically seen in electron experiments which are already being looked for by Sensei and co. It's very difficult to construct a standard model-only mediator that couples to only baryons but not electrons. It's the point I'm trying to make here. Okay. Maxim had an important point over lunch, which I did not rebut properly, so here is his plot. So he tried to do exactly this, except he produced it baryonically and decays it through electrons or through a muonic force. So here's your electronic force, and here's your muonic force. And he was interested in these combinations because, again, these models are ubiquitous. But the point I was trying to make to him yesterday was that if you had a baryonic-only force, then the decay would be much longer. Okay. Having said all that, he needs a 5 petabecquerel source. And here are major nuclear disasters which produced typically this amount of... But the point I'm trying to make is that if you need 5 petabecquerel, you need to take something like Borexino and go sit next to a nuclear waste facility or next to a nuclear reactor. Which is a fair thing to do. But the point is that you need to be super convincing to take a 380-ton precision experiment and sit next to such a hot source. Okay. So you had a question?
So in what he's saying, if you're assuming go to muon, why doesn't it decay to the pion if you just couple to...
Oh, because this is 2 MeV.
Oh, sorry, yes. Okay, good. Because you mentioned muon, and I was like, okay,
right. Sorry. It's coupled to muons, but it always decays photonically in this case, and it decays to E minus if you go above the 1 MeV threshold in the case of electrons. But regardless, you see that even if I have these couplings, if I include a muonic coupling, you see that epsilon squares I can go to are around 10 to the minus 11. And a lot of this is because you're producing it and decaying it, right? And if you go to 10 to the minus 15, you need to take the second power of this. And soon you reach a point where all the particles on the Earth are not enough for such a procedure.
Going back to Maxim's point from yesterday, too bad he's not here today.
Yeah.
So when you produce it. But now the question is if the decay, as he was saying, it comes for free.
Right.
So if you had, even if you cannot access the pion, you'll still decay due to photons.
But it doesn't come for free always. If you keep reducing the epsilon, the decay to standard model has a larger and larger length.
No, I agree. But the question is, if for these similar epsilons, let's say epsilon squared of 10 to the minus 11.
Right.
What is the decay length?
That decay length.
For something that would decay, because you would always decay to photons.
Agreed. But. So if I'm not wrong, he has a 2-meter-ish,
detector versus
detector to source. Distance. And if I'm not wrong, these are the V taus, the C taus in this case, but I'm not so sure. But regardless, a 5-petabecquerel source is a very, very hot source.
Yes.
You have to you don't do this in a lab. You, I think, have to go to a nuclear waste facility, which is probably what he had in mind, right? And also, you can poke perverse holes in this, ask if what if the decay is faster? What if the decay is to invisibles? Of course, you can always say, oh, maybe CMB constraints forbid that. But maybe you can dilute baryons enough you already dilute baryons enough to the CMB. Maybe those limits do not apply. So it's not very clear. So finally, I need to remind you that SOX is an experiment that was canceled. So there is probably not a 1,000-ton tank that's coming up in the near future. And also, once those experiments are finally completed, I do not know what the momentum would be to put them next to nuclear waste facilities.
SOX was the thing you were saying about.
Yes, was the one that was canceled.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is something I want to point out. It's a very good idea. We got a lot of our calculations from this plot, but we believe we can do much better with a much cooler source. Okay. Why is that? Because we do MET. If you do missing energy experiments, you stay agnostic to the decay modes, but further pay small factor only once. Of course, you might pay the small factor only once when you do decay. You need to go to an extremely hot source. How do we do this for a baryonic force, though? Doing MET searches for baryon is a METI enterprise. Again, I just want to, this is a tease. Can I do something with 10 megabecquerel instead of petabecquerel, which is 10 to the 15? This comes to our Gandhi experiment, gamma from nuclear decays hiding from investigators. And this, in some sense, is our detector methodology right here. And I'll tell you what exactly it is. Need for large statistic, typically electrons on target in a beam type experiment. Instead, you're using the large Avogadro number of decaying nuclei. That's a naturally large number. Can we do gamma nuclear decays and look for MET? That's the question. How difficult is this idea? What do you need? You need some isotopes that are long-lived, that are stable gamma emitters. And you need a decay sequence that is triggerable, because after all, you could have a crazy number of gammas. If there's a single gamma, you actually don't know that the gamma decay happened. And that's a problem, right? You need to trigger on this. And industrial production is a plus. And what we got very lucky in that a lot of medical physics that uses some of this gamma emitters have exactly all the things we are requiring. Maybe approximately a megabecquerel, maybe that's a little too much for them, but they're looking for industrial production and they're looking for gamma rays in an MeV. I actually don't know why exactly they need MeV gammas, but that is what it is. And the candidates are 60 cobalt, 24 sodium, 65 nickel, and I'll tell you a little bit about each of them in a second. So cascade gammas in cobalt, so you have 60 cobalt that most of the time decays through the beta 1. And then it cascade decays gamma 1 and then finally gamma 2. Why does it do this? It has a spin of 5 plus to start with. It goes to the 4 plus, and then it prefers to do two E2s rather than an E4 directly. Right? It has a higher rate of doing this. Now, there can also be a beta 3 that produces just a gamma 2, or a beta 1 that produces a gamma 3 and a subsequent gamma 4. But the point I want to make is that if you measure a gamma 1, and you're really good at measuring gamma 1s, you know for sure that these are gamma 1s, and there is no way you will miss gamma 2. There's no way to go to the ground state without giving out the gamma 2. So then the question is, can I measure gamma 1 very, very well and look for the miss of the subsequent gamma 2, and that would be my signal? And of course, I'm limited by how energetic gamma 2 is, and that's around 1.33 MeV. And that's the highest I can go to. But it's good enough for most of the low-scale dark matter experiments which look for massless mediators. How do we do this? You have a cobalt foil inside a hermetically sealed detector. I'll tell you a little more about what these hermetically sealed detectors are made of. You trigger on the first gamma. Signal event is you measure the beta, the first gamma, and then miss on the subsequent second gamma. Okay. Photon detection, you need minimal dead time, because if you had some dead time and you missed the second gamma, that's a problem. So any way in which a second gamma is missed would be mimicking signal. It's a huge background, so you need to be very, very careful in terms of not being able to miss the second gamma.
How close to each other do they come? What is the delta?
Typically, a few picoseconds.
Oh, it's pretty fast.
Pretty fast, yeah.
Okay.
And pretty fast.
Is there some correlation in the direction of the two?
No, because it's.
It doesn't help.
There's no correlation between the two.
Right.
Yeah. That would be amazing if that was there. Then we just need to have. We don't need a hermeticity anymore if that was true, right? But it's not, and it's a big problem. So if you grow a detector and it has a crack, you're screwed. You're not going to be able to do anything. You need minimal dead regions, cracks. You need hermeticity. You need low intrinsic radioactivity. Large detector volumes might be required to make sure second gamma was not missed. And it's very difficult to grow these crystals, so we use a plastic detector. And I'll put this here to sound sophisticated, but I have no idea what exactly this BC404 is. And that's in some sense why I have these experiment collaborators who know all these plastic scintillators very well. So I can't tell you too much about what exactly that scintillator is and so on. But what I know is that it's a typical plastic scintillator, and we use that because we need better timing resolution than crystals, and these crystals are also very hard to grow, because as we need very, very large radiation lengths in order to stop the second gamma. So the plastic scintillator is actually less dense than these crystal scintillators. So we might even need a 5 meter by 5 meter cube if we were looking for just a plastic scintillator to cover the whole supernova window. So I'll show you how with some modest experimental setup we can start probing new parameter space. But if you want to probe the full supernova window, we might have to do a little bit of preposterity to achieve that. We could also try a hybrid plastic scintillator core and a liquid scintillator exterior. So the ideal thing would have been to just go sit in one of these liquid scintillators that are looking for, say, neutrinos, double beta decay, or something like a Borexino, because they are naturally large. They are 400-ton experiments. So these are naturally large. But the problem is that with liquid scintillators, the energy resolution is not very good. And I'll tell you why we need energy resolution in a moment. So here's my detector scheme. It's divided into three modules. There's a central module that's in blue here to completely stop the betas. There's an inner module which detects the majority of the gammas, which is approximately 10 centimeter big. But we require that the first gamma is detected here. Of course, there would be some first gammas which go outside, and we take an order one hit in the signal rate, but we avoid a lot of background by doing this. And an outer module that depending on the efficiency required. So if I want to go to epsilon 10 to the 14, say, I would need 14 radiation lengths of this plastic. A big problem, as I was alluding to, there is energy resolution that needs to be taken care of very well, and that is the 1.33 MeV gamma, which is gamma 2, mimicking gamma 1. So here's the story. There is a beta that goes directly to the lower state. It produces a 1.33 MeV gamma, and because of my poor energy resolution, I wrongly think that 1.33 is a 1.17. And this is the problem in a liquid scintillator. Then I would, in some sense, be restricted by how well I can do this in a liquid scintillator times the smaller branching fraction to go to the lower state. And that's why we prefer a plastic scintillator. So this is a plastic scintillator. And remember that all this happens in the inner module, because inner module will be differentiating between the gamma 2s and gamma 1s. That's where I want my gamma 1 to happen. So if my gamma 2 happens in the inner module, that's the problem. That would be the whole story. So I can have the liquid scintillator all around where energy resolution is not that important, because I've already made my gamma 1 in my inner module. Regardless, even inside a solid state scintillator, the energy resolution is not that great. And what will happen is that they would need larger and larger cuts to differentiate the tails of the 1.33 and 1.17. So at some point, you'll have diminishing returns as a function of larger statistics. And this would be the ideal scenario. I've put 24 Na here. I've not told you more about it. The point is that with 24 sodium, the two lines are far apart, so you do not have this problem. So in this case, you see these different lines here. But typically, what you do is you cannot do GP hat better than 10 to the minus 5, that corresponds to 10 to the minus 10 in efficiency squared that in Maxim's plot. So even in spite of these restrictions, cobalt 60 can do 10 to the minus 7 with say 10 to the 14 decays. And 10 to the 14 decays is approximately a megabecquerel, and that's what I was trying to advertise earlier. 24 Na does not suffer from this. So let's quickly look at what 24 Na is. Firstly, it's a 15-hour experiment, which would mean that someone has to open and close these things every 15 hours, right? But for a year. And this is hot enough a source that one person cannot do this more than once a year. So you might need 700 people to do something like this. And you would also need the source to be made very close to your detector.
What do you make?
So some kind of neutron bombardment, neutron facilities can produce something. But again, 24 Na is used in scientific in medical
very small
amounts.
but
a megabecquerel is not too much. So a megabecquerel of cobalt is available in almost any lab. And 24 Na less so, but it's an advanced field producing these things. And so we have not worked out, again, how we would construct hermeticity at the same time have multiple openings and closings. These are all things which need to be analyzed. So the way we envision this is we would start with cobalt and then move to sodium once our experiment is mature enough. I would like to state that before. But then I would like to point out there is a very small branching fraction for gamma 3, which then goes to gamma 2, and gamma 2 is 4.24 MeV. So with a very small branching fraction, you can actually have access all the way to 4 MeV scalars. Here's a toy model I'm trying to constrain. Again, I construct this more out of being extremely lackadaisical. So if I instead had couplings that were both with protons and neutrons, I would have a much more difficult matrix element to compute. I would need nuclear physics and nuclear physics wave functions to calculate these transitions. So instead, I assume a PP bar, and I agree that if we were to instead constrain a nuclear force, which coupled democratically to both protons and neutrons, a more complicated calculation might be needed. But you do not expect it to be order of magnitude different from the limits I'm going to show. Point is that for an E2 transition, you can make this quadrupolar coupling between your scalar and the quadrupolar moment, and in the case of gamma, it's exactly the same matrix element that couples to polarization. So because of this trick, what happens is that the universal branching fraction to scalars goes like GP over E the whole square times this hit you take because of your phase space. And but you notice this half, and that's telling you that there are two polarizations for the photon, and there's one scalar. And there's an overall GP over E the whole square, which we call GP hat, which stands for epsilon in some sense in the other language. This is your reach. This is the proton radius puzzle. I don't think the word is out whether this is resolved or not, but the point is that it would require a force that couples to both muons and protons. One could be super ambitious and try to solve two discrepancies at the same time. So you require the scalar to solve muon g minus 2. That sets its coupling there. And then you ask what is its corresponding nuclear coupling. And you see that this is the limit that comes from that. But you might see that it's already ruled out by k to pi phi, right? So it's already ruled out, but then this is a UV model. So someone could be, that's not me, could be extremely perverse and say, maybe there's some other way to construct a nuclear force. So if you were priding yourself in only nuclear force measurements, then you would look for something like this. And here, with 10 to the 9 decays, we can actually start already doing better than binding in nuclear matter, which is the only existing limit of such a thing, which purely between nuclei. However, if we had to be taken seriously, we would need 10 to the 9 decays of sodium, or 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 14 decays of cobalt, which starts opening up this parameter space. That is truly new parameter space that can be probed. If we were to do 10 to the 14 decays of sodium, then we can actually cover all of the supernova trapping window. And that would require a megabecquerel of sodium. So in this case, we have done a more careful analysis of backgrounds, because it was super important in this experiment. So in the case of cobalt, it has a 30-year lifetime. Most of the shorter-lived nuclei decay, and most of the longer-lived nuclei do not have energies of typically closer to an MeV. Of course, there are exceptions. Like I think potassium 40 has a 1.3-ish MeV line, but it does not produce two photons in time coincidence. And so in some sense, it's very similar to mismeasuring the 1.33 MeV gamma as a 1.17 MeV gamma. So the rates are pretty similar, and it's mitigated that way.
I have another question. Well, how often would you actually just not detect? What is the efficiency of your detectors? Because you would, so what is the probability that you actually just miss one of them?
So there is some electronic failure or something like that?
Or whatever. I mean, all detectors have a certain efficiency.
Right.
It's never 100%.
Right.
And you're looking for something like, so in these 10 to the 14 decays, you're assuming that one time you lose.
I agree with you.
So what is the probability that you actually just miss the photon by accident?
So we asked experimentalists this question. They seem confident that should be lower than 10 to the 14. I do not know what would the exact process be. Mm-hmm. We looked at things like electronic failure. We looked at things like dead times between measurements. Things like that. So if your thing is too hot and it keeps bombarding you, there's typically a nanosecond gap between different pulses, and you need to be clever in terms of your triggering technology and turning off and turning on. So you take a beating in terms of the total exposure. Instead of a year, you probably do 2 years to get the same kind of exposure. But again, I do not know the complete answer to this question if such a thing exists.
So how much like a radiation like damage can like
So the radiation damage that causes dead regions in plastic is typically, what is it? I should know this. It's, if I'm not wrong, a gigabecquerel.
Oh, okay. So you have
wrong. Right. A gigabecquerel a year or something like that is, again, we should also have total time, right, in order to compute this damage. And a gigabecquerel a year was the hottest people.
To cause damage what? Level?
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, here again, you require some very, one event per 10 to the.
That is true.
Right?
That is true.
So.
So yeah, I do not know if this this science is very precise, and these things need to be looked at, and I do not know for sure the answers to the specific answers to these questions, and these would of course be addressed in a more serious experimental paper that thinks about these questions more carefully, and we are in talks with Marco Battagliari for possibly doing follow-ups where these can be done more seriously and asking what is truly the limits of all these lines, which could possibly be more conservative than what we show here. Okay, here's something fun. Again, if there were E-naught transitions, a scalar decaying to a scalar, you cannot produce a single photon. You have to produce two photons. Whereas a scalar can decay to two scalars, so you would have an enhanced rate to scalar. Furthermore, you would have two photons instead of your scalar. And it's way more difficult to miss two photons than a single photon. But we couldn't explore this too much further because the E-naughts we found are not as energetic. So they would be in the 300 to 400 kV range. But that's something that could be explored in the future to do better in terms of efficiency, but taking a hit in terms of the largest scalar mass you could possibly do. And finally, there are M1 transitions. I mentioned one more isotope earlier, which I didn't come to during the talk. And that's an M1 transition, which means that it's going to something like a 2 plus to a 1 plus or something like that. And that could be useful for axion searches in these parameter space. And that's also something we are willing to explore in the future. I will stop here. There's a part three which is fun, but I think we're I just want to conclude. A rich spectrum of molecules and nuclei could be used for unique dark matter experiments. Molecular vibrations for light dark matter, nuclear gamma decays for baryonic forces. Finally, I didn't show you the nuclear isomers, but it's anyway work in progress, and maybe it should be more mature before being presented in a serious setting. I'd just like to stop with showing you this cartoon, which essentially says that if you're looking under a lamppost, it's nice to build many lampposts, and that is one way of looking at this.
To the right, you can fall in the water.
That is true. That is true. That is true. Thank you very much for your time.
Questions or
requests? Yeah. I think Hanek has had enough.
No. See, I'm not sweating anymore.
No, it's good. Thank you so much.
Sweating.
Thank you so much, Hanek.
Thank you. Okay.